We've got a special guest on the air right now. We've got Kristen Thompson on the phone with us, and she is with the Future of Music Coalition, and we were just looking at a post called "Does Radio Matter?" which was on the web page of the Future of Music Coalition. It caught our eye as radio hosts and as participants in this community radio station. It was a summary of a report called "Does Radio Airplay Matter?" by the project Artist Revenue Streams. The report looked at the changing impact of radio from the perspective of musicians and composers and managers. So we've asked Kristen to come on the air and talk to us a little bit about the report. Kristen, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. So first, could you tell us a little bit about the project Artist Revenue Streams?
Yeah. Artist Revenue Streams is a cross-genre, multi-method effort that's being conducted by the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition to try and figure out how musicians' revenue streams, what they are, and how they're changing over time, and why. And the reason that we started the Artist Revenue Streams project about a year and a half ago was the evolution of Future Music Coalition's mission in the space to sort of help musicians understand the complex issues at the intersection of music, law, technology, and policy. So for the past 10 or 12 years, we've been helping musicians kind of navigate this crazy changes. But we were curious ourselves, you know, there's a lot of assumptions made that these changes, that these technological and social changes have made musicians' access to the marketplace much better, much easier. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true that a lot of the old sort of hurdles and bottlenecks are much easier to route around now. But a question for Future Music Coalition and myself in particular is, how have these changed musicians' ability to make a living?
Can you talk about what people's knee-jerk responses were or reactions to a conversation about radio, about broadcast radio? What was how would you characterize that response?
Yeah, it's very interesting because with the Artist Revenue Streams project, we collected information and data directly from musicians and composers through three methods simultaneously. And when we did the interviews with a variety of musician types, you know, maybe it's a Nashville songwriter, or an indie rocker or a hard rock band that tours all the time. And the reactions were very, very specific and unique to the fields that they're in, kind of. Mm. The country songwriters and the managers that come from the country community talk about how important country radio in particular, but commercial radio has been for their genre. Whereas, interestingly, a metal band I interviewed had found great success in not only college radio, but also in Sirius XM, because there's specialized channels that really focus on hard rock. But then there's some other musicians who thought that radio really they like it when they can get airplay, but they don't count on it. So it's so rare in some instances for jazz and classical artists to get airplay that they, you know, they appreciate it when it happens, but they don't count on it.
And can you talk a little bit about some of those alternatives? Some, like, I think in the report it calls them radio-like experiences or radio-like services, like Sirius XM. What are some of the other ones, and how did they play into the findings?
Yeah, there have been quite a few that have developed over the past 12 years, and we call them radio-like experiences because to the listener, it really feels the same. You know, whether you're listening to whether you turn on your radio in your car or you are listening to a webcast through your computer or on your mobile phone, a lot of it feels the same because it's all push technology. There's somebody that's curating this music, what's happening, what's being delivered to them. And so they just benefit from listening to whatever the DJ is picking or whatever. So amongst the sort of radio-like experiences are now not only commercial radio, but also non-commercial, including, you know, community-supported radio like GXC. There's also college radio. There's NPR itself and all its music-focused shows that they now produce. Pandora, all the webcasts that are sort of webcast-only stations that don't have a terrestrial footprint. And then there's Sirius XM.
Hmm. I was interested in the report to hear about the Telecommunications Act in 1996 and how radio deregulation shifted radio's role in the music industry. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Future Music Coalition has done quite a bit of work on the impact of the 1996 Telecommunications Act on the entire radio landscape. We've published a few reports about it, usually through the lens of how it's impacted musicians and the public, and how what kind of radio experience we can expect, mostly from the commercial side. But I was surprised that when we asked interviewees about, you know, do you get played on the radio or what do you think about radio, a number of people, unprompted by us, talked about how much the 1996 Act had actually impacted their community. And especially came up with the country, the folks from Nashville that relied on country music airplay. And I think it was probably what we got from the interviews is something that was really pervasive in our prior work, our prior research on the topic, was that playlists shrunk. They became much more nationalized. There was programming that was not controlled at the local level anymore, but by a regional program director and sometimes a national program director. And I think country music, which relies so heavily on airplay in order to move country, in order to create more awareness amongst country listeners about new and emerging talent, that I think they were particularly hard hit by this this change in the way it operated. Instead of getting to know your local program director or music director, now it's a regional person, and you know that gets much more difficult to access people like that.
I noticed that you guys really took apart the various revenue streams that musicians are tapping into these days. Are there new revenue streams, I mean, either through Sirius or through internet radio, that musicians are able to access that they weren't able to access before?
Yes. And in fact, there is a revenue stream that is a direct outgrowth of webcasting and satellite radio work, which is called the digital performance royalty. It didn't. It came into being in about 1998 with the passage of federal legislation that created a digital performance right for sound recordings. And so this means that when stuff gets played through your webcasts or through SiriusXM or Pandora or any of the big webcasters, there's each of those providers pays SoundExchange. It's kind of a blanket license arrangement like you guys have with ASCAP and BMI, where there's a certain amount of money and playlists go to to SoundExchange, which then redirects the money to various rights holders. And in the case of SoundExchange, the money goes 45% to the featured performer, 50% to the sound recording copyright owner, which is usually a record label, but could be an artist if they're releasing their work. And 5% goes to session singers and performers, if there are any. So say you're a jazz band leader and there's session players on work, there's a 5% pool of money that's managed by AFM and AFTRA together that pays them when their music is webcast.
I see. Kristen, you sort of cut out for a second there, but the third category was session players?
Background players, session players, just the non-featured performers.
Right. That is so interesting. You know what's so interesting about that from the perspective of a radio station, or especially a radio station of our size, a small non-commercial radio station, the sound exchange reporting that we have to do as a station has been a major pain in the butt because they're really comprehensive. So we have to submit quarterly some pretty serious reports to them about the start and end time and artist and title, song title and label of everything that we play. And it's really tough to manage at a radio station of our size. And then so that's for digital royalties, like you were just saying. And then for the CSAC and BMI and ASCAP stuff, they don't really ask for reports from us because we're a small non-commercial station, which from an administrative end here is sort of gives us a sigh of relief because it's less work for us, but it really does shift when you think about the perspective of artists and musicians and how what gets aired on stations like ours actually translates into some revenue.
Absolutely. And I know there's an administrative burden, and the smaller the station, the heavier the burden for sure. But yeah, it is interesting to see. And one really great part about SoundExchange, which is similar to how ASCAP and BMI work, is that different rights holders are paid directly and simultaneously. So the money doesn't get routed through the artist's record label which then would supposedly pay the artist. No, instead, the artist is paid directly, the label is paid separately, and the session players are paid in a different category. So yeah, I think it's a fair way for artists to be compensated.
So all that said, did the musicians and composers and music managers that you spoke to consider digital royalties and other royalties a significant part of their income?
Yeah, what they said about radio varied a lot, but there were some key things that came out, and it varied mostly according to genre, but sometimes according to the person's kind of stature in the music community. But for some artists, radio airplay seemed almost essential if they expected to reach certain plateaus in their field, you know, especially rock and urban and country. A certain amount of commercial airplay is kind of a prerequisite to sell a certain number of records. But, you know, that's a very small part of the music community in America. And so for others, airplay meant something different. Sometimes it just meant brand awareness. And it meant that more people just knew about them. Sometimes it meant more people would come to their shows, which is fantastic. And other times it was less apparent, there was very little of a direct connection between airplay and something else. But most people welcomed it whenever it happened. That's one thing. But also there is this revenue component under all of it. And there's not only the money on the composer side, that's the ASCAP BMI CSAC money, but the fact that there's these digital performance royalties that happen through webcasts is another thing. There's these two places where money can be made just from the act of music being streamed or performed on a radio. And what your question was, like, do they see a difference? And I was surprised that everywhere from jazz to classical to metal, they were recognizing, they could see, if they were aware of Sound Exchange and they were members of it and were collecting royalties, they could see that money. And they talked about how it was becoming a revenue stream of its own.
It is. We were just talking about printing bumper stickers here, and we were trying to decide what needed to be bigger, the 90.7, which is what you can tune into if you're here in our listening area, or whether we needed to make WGXC larger, because it was going to be more likely that people were tuning in online. And we were trying to think ahead a little bit and try to imagine the future of people's access to radio in their car. Would that be digital too? And we were sort of having these speculative conversations just at a staff meeting, trying to make a really practical decision about what to print. So I'm wondering, I know it's a little bit more complicated, but you guys posed the question, does radio matter? And when someone asks you, does it matter? How do you respond?
I say, yes, it does matter, but we have to think about radio in a broader way than it's been sort of defined up to this point. So let's think about what radio has meant for musicians for a long time, and that's been its promotional power and the curating role that radio stations have played for a long time, the ones that play music. And those two things, those sort of core qualities, you know, the fact that they have huge broadcast reach and also that they play a curating role and sort of push music to listeners who might discover something through this new means, are, I think, two very powerful things that radio has done, whatever the form it is, whether it's commercial, non-commercial, community-based radio, or Pandora. So I think they're important and they remain important. And in fact, the fact that there's more ways for people to experience radio is a good thing. And I don't see that changing. I don't see that diminishing in the next little while. I think that there will be continued efforts in the space to make the radio-like experience more mobile in your car dashboard. And that pretty soon, and I mean, it already exists, but it'll probably be more prevalent, is that you'll get webcast stations available in your car. So, you know, I don't know how your bumper sticker ideas are going to get, realized. It's very, I mean, for folks in the radio community, I wonder, it was great to hear your story, because I'm not sure what I would say either. Like,
right.
You know, it's changing so quickly.
Well, and it's part of what comes up in those conversations here is that there's a piece for us about the magic of the FM dial, the thrill and wonder of a radio that does feel sort of eternal. And that's specifically about the terrestrial dial and not about our digital stream. And that feels, it's hard to imagine that dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, radio, you know it, the fact that it's free and ubiquitous and literacy neutral is such a powerful thing that is difficult to replicate.
Right. I have one more question for you, Kristen, just because you mentioned when you first came on that this particular report had special importance to you. I'm wondering if you can just tell us what brought you to do this kind of work, if you have any specific interest in the question.
Well, I do have a really strong personal interest in artist revenue streams in general. Musicians, doing this project was a part of my evolution too, as part of Future Music Coalition, and prior to that, running an independent label and being in a band. So I've always been curious about how musicians are navigating this thing, this whole change in landscape. But I think Future Music Coalition not only wants to help musicians better understand it, but they also want to help music fans kind of understand how musicians are organizing their lives, how they're generating value around what they do. And if the Artist Revenue Streams Project can help people better understand how musicians are cobbling together their livings right now, I think maybe we could all just sort of better appreciate how it works.
I said that was the last question, but I just remembered I had one other question. I'm not sure you're going to really know the answer to this, but I was recently in conversation with a couple of people here who own small businesses, small either bars or restaurants that sometimes function as music venues, but that's not their primary function. And they're all also trying to navigate these performance art organizations and whether or not as a bar that plays music over the loudspeaker and sometimes has a musician come in, they're being asked to pay performance arts organizations fees also for royalties. Can you either explain a little bit of that to us and the conversation around that or how that plays into this conversation? It's a little bit stepping away from radio for a second.
I can explain it a little bit. So it's quite a long-standing effort, and in fact probably the genesis of ASCAP and BMI and these performance rights organizations that collectively administer performance rights when music is performed publicly is the sort of exactly what you described, music being played in restaurants or places in public gathering places. So there has always been a tension between business owners who play music, even if it's background music, and the performance rights organizations. And the PROs, I think, have they certainly want to do the best job for their composer and publisher membership, and they want to make sure that they capture as many performances as possible, because that's their role. But it does always has struck attention. I think that the PROs do a pretty good job of making it there's a fairly complicated formula to calculate how much each bar or restaurant owns based on, capacity and how much percentage is, music and this and that. There's a lot of different parts mm-hmm. of the equation. And I think they've done an okay job with that, figuring out what the best rate is for various venue sizes and small restaurants. But I would imagine, because it still is an issue, you hear it quite often, that this is a challenge to balance, the rights of a business against the rights of people whose music is being played. So, I can understand how people often are dealing with it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting conversation. And that was very clear. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for joining us. If you're just tuning in, this is Kristen Thompson from the Future of Music Coalition. We've been talking about this report, Does Radio Airplay Matter? Kristen, can you tell, if someone's listening and wants to learn a little bit more, can you tell them where to go?
Sure. So Does Radio Airplay Matter was released and is available on a website at money.futureofmusic.org. We have other reports there, financial case studies, and additional information about the research project itself.
Well, thanks again, Kristen. We'll talk to you
soon.
Thank
you. Thank you.